योगेन चित्तस्य पदेन वाचा मलं शरीरस्य च वैद्यकेन योपाकरोतं प्रवरं मुनीनां पतञ्जलिं प्राञ्जलिरानतोऽस्मि स्तुवे पतञ्जलिं व्यासं शङ्करं च मुनित्रयं कर्तृसूत्रस्य भाष्यस्य क्रमाद्विवरणस्य च So I am continuing this discussion of the 18th Sutra of Samadhipada. I was trying to explain this part of the Yoga Sutras, more or less as interpreted by Swami Vivekananda. There is a very important reason for this. Commentators have written very extensively on this sutra. It's a very important sutra. It deals with the higher concentration called Samprajnata Samadhi. If you read them, you feel that the commentators expect or they expect that you are already familiar with the all other systems of philosophy. So even the translations also cannot throw much light on the practical implications of the message explained in this sutra. That's why I was trying to expound and explain this in the light of Vivekananda's translation. Virama pratyabhyasa purvaka samskarasesho anyeha. The higher concentration is explained, which is called asamprajnata samadhi, where you get complete control over your nature, of your attitudes, and also the way you react with the world. You could get complete mastery not by becoming a master of them, but rather by transcending them. So these are two levels in the evolution. In the Samprajnata Samadhi, you get mastery, but still you are within the control of avidya or maybe imperfections. So the early Samadhi, that is the Samprajnata Samadhi, gives you an insight, an intuitive understanding into whatever you concentrate upon. True. And so you get great powers, great skills, because you are able to get mastery over the functions of different elements in nature. And you are also able to put effort on your mind. You are able to restrain your mind, control your mind, but there is always a possibility of losing this control. It is compared to seas which are not in close proximity with the fertile soil. That's that. Seeds which are not in close proximity, which don't have any association with the fertile soil, seeds that you have kept in your refrigerator, for example, or maybe in your pocket, those seeds cannot sprout. But if those seeds happen to fall on a fertile ground, it could sprout. So the tendencies, vasanas, samskaras, our impressions or characteristics, which normally become a problem for us, which we want to control, which we want to escape from, which we want to get freedom from, so to speak. You are able to do that so long as you are not in contact with them. To give an example, these examples are not always perfect, you know. No example, no metaphor can do full justice to what that metaphor or example tries to explain. There is a central point in Vedanta and in all logic, called drishtanta dashtantika sambandha. I mean, dashtantika means something that you are trying to explain through an example, let us say. So that example can never do 100% justice to the subject you are going to explain. So that problem is still always there. So I'm giving an example. See, a person, let's say, an alcoholic or drug addict. So I'm giving an example from everyday situation, induced to defense injury. Instead of quoting something from a commentary written 2,000 years back in Sanskrit, you know. So an example, let us say. Somebody who has an obsession, let us say, for internet, for drugs, or alcohol, etc. Or anything which the person wants to get free, get out of, and succeeds, because there is a gap between the person and the object. Let us say you are put in a place where no drug is available, no alcohol is. You go to Saudi Arabia, you cannot, and you have to work in a public office. Say death is, you know, at least death is certainly worse than pampering the senses. So you would rather you abstain from all this. So there is punishment, or it is not available, non-availability, I'll say. So there you are able to be free from it. This example has got one drawback. In the system, Patanjali system, you have attained some degree of control, but in this case there is no control. But still, that control is, it works because you keep yourself away from those objects which you want to get out of, which you want to be away from. So you are able to exercise some degree of control when you are not in close proximity with those objects for which you have an obsession, let us say, an addiction. This is one stage. At a higher stage, even if you're surrounded by all these things, you are not affected. That is the higher renunciation, higher dispassion. I'm giving an example. So a person who has reached asamprajnata samadhi, the higher concentration, through higher renunciation, through higher wisdom, higher ability to direct his senses, his attitudes in a positive direction, even if he's surrounded by these objects of temptation, he won't be caught. He won't be trapped. He won't be affected. He can be free. So there is complete freedom from it. In the former case, there is no freedom. You are able to abstain from it. The person is able to abstain from it, but his mastery is only conditional so long as he is not in touch with those things which he wants to get out of. If you go to a place where there is no computer available and you have an obsession for internet, which happens many people in modern times, you know, there is no Wi-Fi, no internet connection, and you have an obsession for internet. So there is the factor of non-availability, which works for your good. There is no freedom there, but there is mastery in the sense that you are away from it. You don't go out and go in search of it. That much control you have got. But if you happen to come to a place where these things are available, then you won't be able to restrain. This is the first stage. In the second stage, you get this mastery, but you also get complete freedom from it. So if you go to the Vedanta Society of Northern California, San Francisco website, you find a quotation from Vivekananda, where Swami Vivekananda, okay, I'm not exactly quoting his words, but you find in the website, where Swamiji says, if you can stand right in the middle of Market Street in San Francisco with all the vehicles moving about, Market Street 1892, 93, means much less crowded than today. So Swami Vivekananda writes, still if your mind is calm and quiet, if you can feel complete tranquility, peace, then there is complete freedom. So that is the higher concentration. There is mastery and there is also freedom. In the earlier case, there is only conditional mastery, there is no freedom. So these are two levels. In the 18th sutra, Virama Pratyaya Abhyasa Purva Samskara Sesho Anyaha is mentioned. The meaning is simple. Those who reach the higher level of concentration, there is a tendency remaining in your mental system, but you have transcended, your attraction for it. So, samskara sesha means a little bit of samskara impression coming from previous life may be there, but it won't take the form of an action. In the previous case, in the early stage of renunciation, it could tempt action. That's what Vivekananda is now. He is trying to continue his explanation. So I have just given the background. So we are discussing these higher tendencies. And Vivekananda says, these tendencies or seeds become waves again when time comes. When you do not have complete freedom from it, you have only relative control but not freedom. So that's the first stage. So Vivekananda continues that discussion. In a concentration where there is consciousness, as in prajna, virisamprajnata samadhi, where the mind succeeds only in quelling the waves in the chitta and holding them down, the waves remain in the form of tendencies. It's like seeds that you have kept in a refrigerator. It cannot sprout. But see, the same seeds, if you walk and if you throw in a fertile soil, it becomes a plant or a tree. That's the idea. That's the first stage in this evolution of concentration. Concentration with total dispassion is called paravairagyam. It's called. So they're unburned seeds, seeds which can potentially sprout if. If you put in a fertile soil and put water and manure, so that's what happens. People in the early stage of their spiritual life, even for children when they are growing up, they should be kept away from things which are undesirable. Because they may have, and all of us have brought with us a bundle of these samskaras and tendencies in our mental system. Some of them are very good, some of them are not so very good. So you have to remember, this is the opposite of what John Locke said, you know, the tabula rasa. Mind is like an empty slate. Just the opposite. Rather, Vedanta and Yoga says, our mind, we are not born with an empty slate. Our mind is not an empty slate. So many things are returned, good and bad both. So mind, the chittam, the mental system, we inherit from previous life. And it is full of tendencies, some of them very good, some of them not at all good. So people who think that children should be given full freedom, whatever they want, you should not quote me out of context. I don't mean to say that you should exercise the rule of boys would be boys, with you spare a stick and spoil a child. Not that sort of thing I'm talking about. But children should be given an opportunity where they can only imbibe good things so that unhealthy, undesirable tendencies which they have inherited from the previous life cycle do not get an opportunity to sprout, because those seeds are there. So if you give them an opportunity for these unpleasant, undesirable tendencies to grow, to connect in this life, then you'd be doing an injustice. Because those, then Vivekananda says, in the coming sentences, he's going to explain the other side of it. So those who have not reached this complete freedom, these tendencies or seeds become waves again. Why? Suppose children who have, not all human beings have brought with them good and bad tendencies from previous life cycles. They are like seeds which are not burned. So these seeds can become waves. Waves mean vritti. Waves are nothing but vrittis. That's why people who happen to grow in neighborhood where there are many risks to get into unpleasant, undesirable habits or association also create the same situation, but the unpleasant tendencies already accumulated in the mental system from innumerable previous life cycles can come to the surface. When they come to the surface, they become a vritti. And when it becomes a vritti, then it becomes karma. And when it becomes a karma, then again, these unpleasant, undesirable tendencies get reinforced. Every repetition reinforces, strengthens an already accumulated undesirable tendency. So it is important that we should try to keep children out of circumstances where undesirable tendencies accumulated in previous life do not get the chance to connect and to become vrittis. And if it becomes vritti, the vritti will become karma. Vritti is the residual effect of karma. Rather, it is subtle dimension of karma. So vritti is, it comes in the form of, let us say, people who have got out of these problems, drug addiction, alcoholism, etc., due to medical treatment through many processes, if they again happen to live in the company of those who may have these habits or in places where these things are easily available, then what happens? These controlled samskaras will become vritti, and vritti will become a karma. They get money, they go and buy and get it. So that is what happens. Then Vivekananda talks about the higher asamprajnata samadhi. But when you have destroyed all these tendencies, almost destroyed the mind, then the samadhi becomes seedless. Seedless means all the tendencies, they lose their ability to function, to connect. They cannot become vrittis and they will not become vasanas. So as I mentioned in the previous class, if seeds are burned or if you cook them and then if you throw in a very fertile soil, it will not sprout. That's like Vivekananda's example, you know. Somebody who stands in the middle of San Francisco Market Street, in the midst of all these crowds and vehicles, still can feel intense tranquility and peace within. It means all these external noises or disturbances have no effect at all in our mind. Where our mind has attained not only mastery, but also freedom by transcending. Not by getting rid of, but transcending mind. That means we go beyond mind. How to go beyond mind? Going beyond mind in actual practice from a psychological point of view, it means going beyond conflicts. That's what it means. Going beyond mind in actual practice means going beyond conflicts. You may ask the question, why? You know, mind, you cannot wish away the mind. If somebody tries to do that, the result will be vacuum. And when this vacuum is experienced, it can lead to a deadening of our mental functions, and one may become dumb, he may lose his ability to think. So one cannot deny one's mind, but one can transcend the mind. Transcending the mind means transcending these conflicting vrittis, the realm of these conflicting vrittis, tendencies and samskaras, through asamprajnata samadhi, the higher concentration, where you give up all your attachment. Through dispassion, you develop this extreme dispassion even towards the subtle tendencies or undesirable attitudes which can be a problem for us. It's called paravairagya. But when you have destroyed all these tendencies, almost destroyed the mind. I mean, destruction of tendencies means destroy the mind. Here, destroy the mind should be understood transcending the mind. So very often, you know, Vivekananda was an eloquent speaker and writer. So very often, the language used could be very powerful depending upon the audience whom he was facing. So destroying the mind means, actually in actual practice, transcending the mind. Transcending the mind means gets complete freedom from the conflicts that normally constitute what mind is. So mind is nothing but an endless stream of thought currents. Modern psychology. Endless stream of thought currents. These thought currents do not always move in one direction. Generally speaking, all the thought processes in our mental system can be divided into two categories, positive and negative. There could be very many diverse forms of thought currents, but they can all be divided, be classified under two categories, the negative and positive. So when you transcend the mind means you transcend this conflict. Then the samadhi becomes seedless. That means all tendencies, all impressions have been completely neutralized when you transcend them. So transcendence implies freedom. Mastery may not always imply freedom. Mastery could be for the time being. There are no seeds in the mind out of which to manufacture again and again this plant of life, this ceaseless round of birth and death. So, again, that intimate connection, the inseparable link between law of karma and the theory of reincarnation should be clearly understood in this context. Those of you who have got the book, you can see, you may be seeing, the 18th sutra. In fact, this occurs in the first Samadhipada itself, so you may be reading. So there are no more seeds in the mind out of which to manufacture again and again this plant of life. Without seeds, there can be no plant. Without tendencies and impressions accumulated in the mind, there can be no reincarnation, again, this life cycle. So again, it should be understood, this continuous life cycle, the cycles of these endless life cycles, is not a very wonderful thing that we should aspire for. It is something that we should get out of. That is a given position in Vedanta and Yoga. Life is not a very desirable thing. Not that its opposite is desirable. Death is desirable. What it means, you should transcend it, not get rid of it. So whenever we discuss the theistic systems of Indian philosophy, whether Mimamsa, Vedanta, Yoga, Sankhya, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, all the theistic systems, and also Buddhist and Jaina systems, one important point that you should always be kept in mind is, we have a higher transcendental spiritual dimension, which is far beyond, far greater than the psychophysical mechanism. So when we talk about transcending life cycles, what is meant is we have to transcend our psychophysical mechanism dimension, and we should identify ourselves with our spiritual dimension, which is one Atman, eternal, absolute reality, which is existence, knowledge, and absolute bliss. This is our true nature. being born in this world, suffering for some time and enjoying for some time, again suffering, this is not a perfect state. In Buddhism, also in Jainism, Buddhism, and also in the in all these theistic systems of Indian philosophy, of which yoga is one. This life, this physical life, is not the highest state of our existence. We have a higher transcendental spiritual dimension. If this physical life is taken to be the only thing, after all, human bodies is nothing but a machine made, let us say, I don't call it machine, that's no other way. Well, from a very material point of view, it is a bag made of skin. And whatever you have within the bag, if it comes out, you should wash your hands with a disinfectant or with soap before you take your food with that hand. So this is a very interesting principle in Vedanta. And this is normally what we call life is nothing but this bag, which contains things which are not very desirable. When they come out of this bag, and we keep it covered with a wonderful clothes, and we want to keep it healthy, maybe 100 years if you eat only organic food and do exercise every day. But still, that is not the happiest, the most desirable. That's on the highest dimension of our real personality. It is only a changing and impermanent and intermediary state which we must transcend. So maybe in Christianity it could be called, you know, going to heaven, in God's kingdom. In Buddhism it's called Nirvana, and in yoga system it is called Samadhi or liberation or Kaivalya, is mentioned here. So in Vedanta it's called realization of the omnipresent immanent spiritual reality. So this is the state. Now, is this state something that we are going to acquire for the first time? No. And in that respect, perhaps, you know, Abrahamic religions also agree. Because there was a state from where we are coming, which is far superior to the present state of affairs, before Adam eat the apple, so to speak. And then all these problems started. And then we are going back to that pristine, higher, glorious existence. This is an Abrahamic tradition. And also in Vedanta, our true nature is not something that we obtain as a result of a spiritual practice. Spiritual practices help you to get back to your house, which is your house. When you go back to your house, it is not a new property. It is a property that belongs to you, that's yours. You have left that home and you're returning home. So realization of this freedom is getting back to our true nature. So these endless life cycles is a state of affairs which should be transcended. It's an intermediary state. So that point should always be kept in mind when we read Yoga Sutra. So the law of karma and the doctrine of reincarnation. Whatever we do, any action, and not only physical action, a thought is also capable of creating a vritti, a residual effect. A word we speak, a flash of ideas in the mind, or physical activity, all can create a residual effect. After the action is over, something is left behind. In our mental system, it registers a tendency, a way which is called vritti, that remains there. Some of them are very good, some of them are certainly not very good. These vrittis, we call vasana, samskaras, tendencies, impressions, they constitute the mental system. And when we burn these seeds by transcending them by spiritual practices, then what happens? We get back to our true nature. So this is a central point to be understood. It is not something that you believe in by reading a book. It is something that we attain in our inner spiritual life through meditation, through the practice of yamas and niyamas, and through the practice of renunciation and dispassion. You may ask, Swami Vivekananda continues, what state would that be in which there is no mind, there is no knowledge? Here knowledge also means, here knowledge doesn't mean the highest spiritual realization. Knowledge here means an information, or what we call a knowledge that you get as a result of sensory perception, the senses and mind coming together, and through cognition you get a lot of information, knowledge. That's the meaning of the knowledge that is meaning of the knowledge which is used here. What we call knowledge is a lower state than the one beyond knowledge. So the state of going beyond knowledge here means the state of going beyond cognitive faculties. Cognition. The cognition always implies mind and senses coming together and perceiving certain things. You must always bear in mind that the extremes look very much alike. If a very low vibration of ether is taken as darkness, an intermediate state as light, very high vibration will be darkness again. So an example is taken. Similarly, ignorance is the lowest state, knowledge is the middle state, and beyond knowledge is the highest state, the two extremes of which seem the same. Going beyond knowledge means, in reality, being established in a state of intuitive experience, intuitive knowledge. The intuition is something that goes beyond the sensory cognition. And it is in the sense of sensory cognition that Vivekananda uses the word knowledge. So going beyond knowledge here means going beyond the knowledge as we understand as sensory perception, intellectual understanding, so on. When you go beyond knowledge, you are not ignorant. Rather, you are already established in a state of knowledge which is higher than the knowledge as we understand in our everyday experience. It is higher intuition. Knowledge itself is a manufactured something, a combination. It is not reality. So when you read these books, that's the sense, because these are ideas taken from the Upanishads. Knowledge, objectified knowledge, is something that is imperfect. It is cognition. And it could change. What you consider to be the right knowledge now could be different. After some time, it could change. What is the result of constant practice of this higher concentration? All old tendencies of restlessness and dullness will be destroyed, as well as the tendencies of goodness too. So you go beyond not only bad, but also you go beyond goods. There also you have to remember, Vedanta and Yoga do not interpret the highest reality as a totality of all goodness. So it's something that goes beyond bad and also going beyond good. Because it has something to do with the Vedanta hermeneutics and epistemology, the theory of knowledge, and the Vedantic Pramana Shastra, as we call epistemology, is very extensive. The idea is, in Vedanta and Yoga, generally speaking, in the theistic systems of Indian philosophy, the highest reality or the highest concept of God is not an anthropomorphic being who is the totality of all the good things in the world. Because if you define God as the totality of all the good things, then you have to posit an equally powerful being as the totality of all the bad things. Because the reality of the bad cannot be ruled out. How do you explain it? People ask this question. So Vedanta and Yoga do not believe, do not accept the theory of evil. Rather, it will accept the theory of error. So, I should try to explain this. In Abrahamic religions and many of the popular Hindu theistic systems like Vaishnava, Shaiva, Shakta, in all non-Advaitic, non-dualistic systems of Indian philosophy, Indian traditions, there is a God who is a very wonderful person, and there is also somebody else who is not so very wonderful. The latter one is responsible for all the problems in the world. It's a very easy thing to do. But the point is, these systems, they are dualistic systems because they accept two fundamental categories. They are dualistic systems. The one supreme God and other is not so very good, but if you pray to God, you can get out of this bad. But in non-dualistic system, there is a rational explanation as to why the bad evil is also a reality, is a part of the same reality. It is not something apart from it. So, instead of saying that another entity is also existing and that entity is embodiment of all the bad things, and the God itself is an entity which is the essence of all good things, instead of saying that, Vedanta and Yoga will tell you the bad or the evil is the result of ignorance. And ignorance should not be understood as intellectual ignorance. It is a result of lack of realization of the absolute reality. So the absolute reality goes beyond good and bad also. Not only beyond bad, but also beyond good. God cannot be limited to the totality of all the good things in the world because that leaves a vacuum. We have to explain the reality of the evil. So the reality of evil cannot be explained as another parallel entity which is the embodiment of all the evil things. Rather, that evil also is part of the whole, the one reality. You transcend this evil through spiritual practice. Then you reach the state of totality of goodness. Then you transcend that also. So again, remember, this is only in Advaita. You transcend evil and then you get established in the goods and then you transcend the good also. So this should be understood. Of course, this is the highest realization. Now, when you transcend the good also, you become well established, you naturally establish in the good so that you can never be bad. So, I shall try to explain this aspect of Indian theistic philosophy with the help of one verse in the Gita. It is supposed to be the Charama Sloka, the conclusion. It comes in 66th verse of the 18th chapter. Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam vraja aham tva sarva papebhyo moksha ishyami ma shucha. It is something like a promise from God, Lord Krishna. What he says is this. You give up, you transcend, you give up all dharma. That's what meaning here. Sarva dharman parityajya. All you give up all dharma and you take refuge in me. I shall protect you from all tragedies, all problems. Don't grieve. This is the literal meaning. Now, the implication as explained in innumerable Sanskrit commentaries, is very, very profound. You know what it means? When you begin our spiritual life, we have to be very careful to avoid the evil, to avoid the bad, and to stick to the good and the positive. This is the first step in spiritual life. That's why, you know, Patanjali insists on yamas and niyamas. Ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, parigraha, shauja, santosha, tapasvadhyaya, isarpanidhana. Non-violence, non-possessiveness, non-stealing, pure life, and then contentment, purity, and so on. All 10 disciplines are mentioned in the yamas and niyamas, the beginning of samadhipada. Through this, you give up all the evil. So, and then you should get established in the good. That's how it happens. But at this stage, you have this equation, good and bad. Bad should be avoided. Good should be accepted. So this you should be careful to avoid doing which is adharma, which is evil, and you should stick to, hold fast to the doctrine of the good, the most auspicious, dharmic, ethical things. True, that's a natural state. That's a natural beginning of spiritual life in all religious traditions. Not only religious traditions, for every civilized human being, these 10 disciplines are essential. When you reach a higher level, when you get established in these yamas and niyamas, suppose you get established in satya, that's the first yama. A person who gets established in satya, then when you get such strong conviction and you are fully identified with satya or truthfulness, then it becomes impossible for you, for us to do anything contrary to that. You cannot tell a lie. For somebody who's naturally established in truthfulness, you cannot tell a lie. So you go beyond the need to discriminate between truth and falsehood, because you naturally get established, identified with truthfulness. When you reach that state, then you go beyond the true, false, good, bad, good, evil equations, because you naturally get established the good in dharma, in truthfulness. So that's the meaning in which Lord Krishna uses this word. Then that's the last stage for every devotee. Then you resign yourself to God. If a person resigns himself to God or herself to God, then there is no need for him to look around, because he can walk, he can live with his closed eyes. He can walk with his closed eyes, because he's at the highest stage of spiritual evolution. If a person completely gets established in this self-surrender, then he need not worry about avoiding the evil, because he gets so fully established in the good that good-bad equation becomes irrelevant to him, and he transcends this. That's the meaning in which it is used. In fact, that is exactly what is meant by Kaivalya freedom, which is the result of Asamprajnata Samadhi. In fact, that's why Vivekananda says you should go beyond knowledge. So knowledge-ignorance equation applies to lower level. When you realize the highest intuition, then you already establish in knowledge. That means you go beyond the knowledge-ignorance the equation. I can try to give an example from the life of a great Indian philosopher who is a great example of this complete resignation. Okay, now there was, you know, in the Mimamsa philosophy, there are two great philosophers, Kumarila Bhatta and Prabhakara. So they may have lived around the 4th century AD. This Kumarila Bhatta, he had to go incognito, and he had to go to a Buddhist teacher who was trying to preach that Vedas, all these things are wrong, there is no God, there is no need to believe in anything. Some kind of an intellectual, spiritual anarchy. You know, this happened around 4th century AD. So historically it's proven in those days. Because Buddhism, at one stage of its history in India, had become some kind of nihilism, cynicism, it's a kind of intellectual, spiritual anarchy, denying everything. Well, I don't want to mention, but if you have read Jai Krishnamurti, you get a glimpse of it. Total, absolute, complete spiritual anarchy. So, I don't mention persons, but there is no need, Jai Krishnamurti. So, he you can see such teachings. This was not the true teachings of Buddhism. You have to remember, this was a deviation from the original teachings of Buddha. This happened in India. It didn't happen in other countries. Because India, you know, the philosophical inquiries and the number of philosophers, philosophical schools are so innumerable. So a lot of conflicts, intellectual conflicts. So as a result of this, at one stage in some parts of the country, Buddhism was wrongly interpreted as some kind of intellectual anarchy. So Kumarila Bhatta was a great exponent of Vedic ritualism, not Vedanta. He did not deny Vedanta, but he was more of a ritualist. So he went incognito as a Buddhist and defeated the greatest Buddhist scholar, philosopher of those days. So he established Vedic ritualism. But then he thought he should do penance for going incognito. So when they discovered that he was a Vedic ritualist, the Buddhist philosophers, what they did, they dragged him to the top of a hill and threw him from the top of the hill as a punishment, when they discovered that he had come incognito to defeat Buddhist philosophers. When he was falling from the top of the hill, he shouted, "If Vedas are right, nothing will happen to me." So if Vedas speak the truth, I won't be affected. Nothing will happen to me. So as he hit the ground, he was okay, only he lost one of his eyes. Why? Because he used the if conditional clause. Instead of saying Vedas are right, so nothing will happen to me, what he said was, if Vedas are okay, all right, nothing will happen to me. So he himself was not fully convinced. So he lost one eye. This is a story, remember? This is a story. Now, this self-surrender, transcending dharma adharma, this complete surrender should be like falling from the top of a hill without any support, and still, well, God is true, so nothing will happen to me. If God is true, nothing will happen to me, then something could happen. You may have to go to hospital at least. But if you say God is right, God is real, so nothing will happen to me, then because you should not use a conditional clause, which shows lack of full faith. So if to understand the meaning of transcending knowledge and ignorance, transcending good and bad, transcending dharma and adharma, we should know this complete identification. Because when you identify that reality, you go beyond the need to discriminate between good and evil. You naturally get established in good, in the good. So it becomes psychologically and physically impossible for us to do anything evil. That is the meaning of transcending, where you master where you get fully established in this. At the lower state, when you are in need of making a discrimination between good and bad, so that you always do your best to avoid the bad, then there is a possibility of one day maybe falling into doing something bad. There's a possibility, there's a possible, maybe a remote risk is there. But you transcend both, then goodness becomes our natural instinctive habit. So there is no need to worry about deviating from goodness. That's exactly the implication of Vivekananda's statement. That's going beyond knowledge. What is the result of constant practice of this higher concentration? All old tendencies of restlessness and dullness will be destroyed. As I mentioned, restlessness is the result of conflicting with vrittis, vasanas and samskaras. There could be 10,000, 10 million, 10 billion samskaras coming from previous life cycles. But generally speaking, they can be divided into two fundamental categories. Tendencies which are good for our spiritual life, tendencies which are not good for spiritual life. As I mentioned, this manifests in the form of a conflict between what we want to do and what we end up doing. This happens in spiritual life when we sometimes when we try to do something and we decide sincerely to do it, when we actually are about to do it, we ourselves, another part of our mental mechanism, gives an excuse for not doing what we sincerely want to do. That negative impulse comes from negative vrittis, samskaras, tendencies already accumulated in the mental system. It could come from any source because it must be accumulated there from hundreds of life cycles. So we'll discuss and then we'll have your interaction. Thank you. We have still 5 minutes. That's the time. Yes. Describing transcending good and bad needs some explanation because it is from a theological point of view, it could create conflicts. That's the idea behind. So that's why it took a lot more time.
You said negative and positive. I was meditating the other day and it kind of made me feel like I had two minds. I have a rational mind and an irrational mind.
That's true. That's how it appears to be.
Yeah, it came to me in my meditation that that's really what happens.
Yeah,
and
Recently
I've just been taking my irrational mind as just something that's not true. It seems like it's some type of cloth over me. Is that okay?
Yeah.
It just... because I know the third eye of wisdom, I feel like that's what clogs it or something. Am I right about that? Or?
That's true, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, when you try to meditate, you find you are talking about a rational mind. That is a secondary personality that emerges from that process.
Mm-hmm.
A more serene, a more rational, a more intelligent, but more intelligent you, in contrast to the less intelligent, the more impulsive you. The two yous are there, you know.
Yeah.
So the secondary personality is trying to emerge and trying to take control. But the negative tendencies manifesting as the former personality before you started meditation may not permit you to do that. So this conflict. So the only way to do is to help the second personality to grow, to take control by reading books associated with this spiritual life and discussing these things, associating with people who are spiritual seekers like you, and also attending programs which are conduce you to the growth of the second personality, spiritual tendencies. You know. If you should constantly do that, then you find that second personality, the rational personality, the rational you grows in stature and becomes more established, and the other one gets weaker and weaker. So, and in direct proportion to this, conflicts start decreasing. That's what happens.
Thank you. Just a quick question. I actually got that book before I came here, not knowing that that's what you were teaching. But he talks about Purusha.
Purusha Prakriti.
What is the difference between that and the Atman? Because it seemed like he said soul. He said soul, but I didn't know.
I'll try to explain. No.
Okay.
Purusha Prakriti, these are two fundamental categories in Sankhya Yoga system.
Okay.
Spiritual teachers, like Vivekananda, great Vedantic teachers, they have accepted some of the minor details of Sankhya Yoga system, but the conclusion of Sankhya Yoga system should be linked to Vedanta.
Mm-hmm.
So you find, if you read Vivekananda's exposition, he gives a Vedantic interpretation of yoga system.
Okay.
Yoga philosophers, if they explain, then there is much less of that spiritual element in it. It's more about controlling the mind, controlling senses, reaching some higher skills and liberation and all that.
Okay.
So yoga system should be understood in the light of Vedanta. So Purusha, as explained the yoga system, is not very rationally, philosophically, it is not a very satisfactory preposition. So according to Vivekananda, we should understand that Purusha to be the Atman.
Okay, so it's the same thing.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's
I got confused because I know.
That's right. That's why when you read Vivekananda, you get this perspective.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Why leave the house at all?
Why?
The house. Why leave the house? Why are we being reborn over and over and over?
Yeah.
Why leave the house? Why is God splitting us into these many people that we see?
You're right.
Why?
You're right. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
I've heard that it's God's play.
That's true. You know, creation, well, in Vedanta, if you ask the question, why should God create this world? The answer is, God did not create this world. That's the highest answer. But that is the last conclusion. Before understanding this concept, you need a lot of background information. So this world and this life, life cycles, all this, are impermanent. So we understand its true nature only when we get out of this, when we realize the true purpose of our life, and then we look back, then only we realize the impermanence of the world and life cycles. If you ask the question, why God should create this world at all, okay, that question is not applicable in Vedanta, because in the highest conclusion of Vedanta, this world is the creation of our own mind, our own thoughts. When we change our thoughts, when we change our perspective, we'll be looking at this world from a different perspective. When a person reaches the highest level of spiritual evolution, enlightenment, if he look at this world, if he looks at the world, he won't be seeing this world, he'll be seeing only Brahman, Atman, God. So when we reach that stage, then we transcend the world. Even the world will be seen as God. I can give the example of one of our Swamis. You can see the picture of the Swami, this Swami Turiyananda. You can see he is the founder of, he was the one who came to Shanti Asama, San Antonio Valley. You know, he started Vedic monastery there, 1900. He was there for 2 years. And he went back to India. When he passed away, he asked all his disciples and other junior Swamis to come near him. Then he asked them to repeat again and again, Brahma Satyam Jagat Satyam. Brahman is real, Jagat, this world also is real. Now, When you reach the highest stage of spiritual experience, this world is not seen as this world, the way we see the world. The world is seen to be non-different from Brahman. Because when we look at this world, we normally interpret this world in terms of names, forms, and diversities, and we interpret and we understand it in the light of our accumulated tendencies and impressions and attitudes. So we see the world through this mind. And we interpret the world. When we transcend the mind, when we get established in the realization we are the Atman, we are the all-permanent, the permanent or omnipresent reality, then we won't be seeing the world the way we see it. We're seeing different. See, you have seen Ramana Maharshi's picture. Many such pictures you find. His eyes are always open. What is he looking at? He's not looking at anything. But his eyes are not closed either. So even when he was living, he was not seeing this world the way we see it. So how do we understand the things of this world do not disturb them? They may be in this world, but they won't be of this world. They won't be of this world. Thus the world is understood to be non-different from Brahman, non-different from Atman. In putting the traditional theistic language, it is non-different from God. That's how it is understood. That's how we transcend the world. That's to be under. Yeah.
In reference to Swami Vivekananda. What you're talking about, was he referring to hypotheticals, or was he himself already existing in a state of realization, transcending the opposites of good and bad, or was he still in a state of movement and striving for what he's talking about?
Yeah. I'll explain this. You know, Vivekananda's teacher, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, once told him, I have given you this knowledge, but this knowledge won't be with you. I shall keep it with you. I shall try to explain the whole background. When Vivekananda reached the highest enlightenment under his training, due to his training under Sri Ramakrishna, then he expressed a desire to his teacher, his guru, I want to remain in this samadhi, meditate all the time. So that was his desire. He didn't want to come to Chicago Parliament of Religion, and he didn't want to go anywhere. He did not even want to travel, walking all over India. He didn't do that. He didn't want to do that. What he wanted was, he wanted to remain in that state of samadhi for all time. That is what he wanted. He told his guru. Then Sri Ramakrishna told him, no, you have to do some good work for the world, for others. And Sri Ramakrishna indicated, this highest realization, I shall keep with me under the lock and key, and I shall give the key to you. The key will be returned to you later. This is how his story goes. So you have to understand the statement in his means a metaphor. I mean, Sri Ramakrishna said, this realization I shall withhold from you. That's what he implied. For the time when you'll be working for the good of the world. And later, towards the end of your life, it will be returned to you. Okay. Now, when Vivekananda, he traveled all over India, he came to this country, he went to Europe, and then after returning to India, he established Ramakrishna Mission, which Vedanta Society is a branch of that. After all that, he was the president of the organization, and he renounced that. He handed over the whole responsibility to another monk. And then, towards the end of his life in 1902, he used to say, no, I feel I can only think of God and Sri Ramakrishna, nothing else. I think the master is giving me back the old realization. After that, he did not take any active interest in the running of the organization or anything. And he himself had a premonition on which day he was going to pass away. And he went to the temple, sat there for a long time, meditation, asked his disciple to stand outside, watching, so nobody would come and disturb. And he came out. He used to take classes, Sanskrit grammar every day, to his disciples. He used to give classes. Came back and taught for 3 hours, Sanskrit grammar, and went back, laid down, long breath, finished. And towards the end of his years, life used to repeat, now I have withdrawn my mind from all this. I think the master is returning, the key master is taking me back. He felt his work was over. So almost like within brackets, I mean, his life from that day, Sri Ramakrishna asked him, you cannot remain in samadhi all your life. You have to spread this Vedanta all around the world. From that day till the last few months of his life, it is within brackets, really. That's how his life. Because you find in the lives of great teachers, first there's an ascent towards higher spiritual realization. Then there is a state when they remain in that state for good. And then they go back to that early state which they reached through this ascent, the early part of this life. You find this. Shankaracharya, see, Shankaracharya was well versed. He studied all the shastra, everything he had mastered before he was 6 years old. And before 16th year, he had already written all the books we are studying. With old pandits take 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, he had already written all those big volumes before he reached the 16th year. And then he was ready to go back. But it seems that his guru, his teacher, was a very divine person. And the story says that Shiva appeared, God appeared and extended his life for another 16 years. Anyway, he lived for another 16 years. And during these 16 years, he traveled all around the country 4 times, established temples, wrote the most beautiful poetry, and renovated temples and all those things he did. You find in the case of Sri Ramakrishna also. Sri Ramakrishna, for 12 years, he did not know when the sun rose in the east and set in the west. He was meditation. But after that time, he was always teaching. It was the end of his life, going back to again. So you find the teaching in the lives of great spiritual teachers, this ascent first, then realization, and then they go back. The same as Buddha. Buddha's spiritual practices took several years. After that, straight away he went to Benares Kashi and he taught the sages who were living there. They were his first disciples. Then he traveled all around the world and lived for 80 years. So you find, in the case of Jesus Christ, you find, for his temptations, his penance, his baptism, it's all that you find. And then these parables, teaching, going around, teachings. So you find that there's an ascent, then there is a state where they continue functioning as missionaries, as a great teacher, as a great spiritual reformer, whatever maybe. And then they feel as if it's going back to their home, which theirs. So you find this happens in the lives of great spiritual teachers, epoch makers in the history of religion and spirituality. Right. Okay. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.